Today's episode examines a case involving a child under the age of 10 and includes discussion of violence and sexual assault, which may be disturbing to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. On a warm, quiet morning, 5-year-old Justin Turner was getting ready for school. Sliding into his clothes and chugging down a bowl of his favorite cereal, the little boy popped his head into the bathroom to tell his stepmother he was off to the neighbor's house to wait for the bus, but he'd never make it. Somewhere between the bathroom door and the end of his driveway, the 5-year-old would mysteriously vanish. 2 long days would pass with searchers covering every inch of space between the Turner home and the bus stop. There was no trace of the child, and not a single witness who had even seen him leaving his house that Friday. Ponds were dragged, woods grid searched, fields were poured over. The more they searched, the more likely it seemed that Justin had been abducted by someone who had taken him out of the area. As the third day of searching began, a disturbing discovery would completely change the direction of the investigation. In a small blue and white camper trailer not far from his home, Justin Turner's body was found, tucked into a storage space beneath a bench. Multiple investigators stated they'd searched the trailer several times, and Justin hadn't been there. Quickly, it would become a question of whether or not they'd somehow missed the boy, or if perhaps someone had managed to sneak him into that trailer right under their noses. Soon, what had seemed like a case with an unknown suspect became a tense examination of those closest to Justin, specifically his father and stepmother. Rumors, speculation, and leaks from official sources clouded the case. Newspaper headlines were rife with unsubstantiated claims and accusations. While investigators struggled to gather evidence and keep it under wraps, the community began questioning their methods and wondering if a killer would walk free because of their mistakes. As the community was united in their criticism, the family was divided between those who believed Justin's father and stepmother were innocent and those who viewed them as the only possible suspects in the murder of a child and its cover-up. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 170, The Murder of Justin Turner, Part 1. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine a disturbing and heartbreaking case involving the murder of a 5-year-old boy. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. A blonde-haired, blue-eyed child goes missing, but no one notices for hours. The crime scene isn't sealed off right away, so friends and family wander through the home and property in search of the missing child. 2 days later, the child's found dead by the father in a space that's supposedly been searched previously. It's later determined that the child had been sexually assaulted sometime after vanishing. Conflicting statements from the family and investigators complicate the case, and while a stranger is initially considered to be responsible, the focus will slowly close in on the family. While this sounds just like a case that has captivated and horrified the world for the past 25 years, this investigation began in 1989 and never had much of a spotlight on it. This is Episode 170, The Murder of Justin Turner. Graying clouds gathered high above thick swaths of variegated farmland and the lush greenery of wilderness on the edge of town. Sunday mornings were often quiet, but this one was more so than usual. The busy streets downtown remained eerily empty, but for the occasional approach of locals here and there who sought their morning coffee and a newspaper. Brushing back the sleepiness of another long weekend, people eagerly flipped through the crinkling pages in search of a hopeful resolution. It had been 2 days since reports of a missing child had blasted across radio waves and jumped out from the fuzzy glow of television sets across the state. Parents had been quick to respond, limiting their children's playtime to boundaries defined by curbs, sidewalks, and fences, fearful of a potential predator on the loose. Early reports had left many in the area unsure of the circumstances. A 5-year-old boy left the home he shared with his father and stepmother to catch the bus, but never made it back. Local residents and authorities speculated about the possibilities. The sheriff would tell the media that they couldn't confirm whether the child had run off, or if perhaps he had been abducted by someone in the area. 2 full days of searches had yielded no results. None of the neighbors had seen anything, and no one knew for certain what might have happened. Ponds had been dragged, woods were combed over, and neighborhood streets were crawling with searchers in hopes of finding some trace of the little boy. By Sunday, the group expanded to the largest yet, as a stream of police, search and rescue squads, and local volunteers made their way down main roads to the winding, quiet streets on the edge of town. The sheriff's department took the lead, assigning different areas to groups of searchers as the radius started expanding. The locations closest to the home had been covered several times and nothing had been found. No shred of clothing, no footprints, nothing to suggest the little boy had ever even been there. The wider the search grew without a trace of the child, the more likely it seemed that an abduction had taken place. The third day of searching officially began just after 8 a.m., as thick cloud coverage concealed the sky and threatened to drop a deluge which would only make the hunt all the more difficult. Then something strange happened, something which to this day no one has been able to provide a solid answer for. Less than 30 minutes into the search for the little boy, the case completely changed shape. There, in a small blue and white trailer sitting behind the home, the boy's father made the tragic discovery. Beneath the seat cushions of a small bench in the dining area of the trailer, behind a sliding door, the child's body was found wedged into a storage area. This discovery, both horrifying and heartbreaking, quickly threw the investigation into chaos. Sheriff's deputies were certain that the camper had been searched on Friday, as well as Saturday, and they were adamant the boy had not been there. The question quickly became, had the child been hidden right under their noses this entire time, or had someone managed to sneak him into that place under the cover of darkness between searches? This would be the first in a long string of unanswered questions which would divide a town, a family, and different bureaus of law enforcement. Justin Lee Turner was born to parents Elaine and Victor Turner in 1983. Justin's been described by neighbors, friends, and family as a sweet little boy with bright blonde hair and 2 bright blue eyes. Many people have commented on the fact that those blue eyes could easily grab attention, but that if you looked at them too closely, there seemed to be a sense of an indefinable sadness locked behind them. Justin was defined by some as socially shy, often playing by himself on his father's property off rural Horseshoe Road. Neighbor Bronzell Blanding had met Justin a few times when he'd come over to play on the swing set with her kids and later told the Greenville News, quote, "He was a sweet little boy. You could tell he was a loner over there by himself. He was nice the times he would come over," end quote. Justin did have friends in the neighborhood, though, and his best friend, Justin Smith's grandmother, lived just across the street. Smith later described his friend telling newspapers, quote, "He was fun, outgoing, very gentle. We'd always just play and hang out," end quote. The two Justins were in the same grade, kindergarten, and got to know each other on the bus which stopped just in front of Smith's grandmother's home. Each morning for school, Justin Turner would arrive at the bus stop almost always under the supervision of his stepmother, Pamela. The boys attended half days for kindergarten, taking the bus around 11 a.m. and returning home around 3. Justin was a lover of baseball from a young age and was especially drawn to the Ladson All-Stars, a team of 11 and 12-year-olds. Not yet old enough to join the team, Justin found his own way in, becoming a mascot for the team, who all described him as bright-eyed, smiling, and always 100% behind their efforts, win or lose. Justin especially looked up to L.M. Garrick, a skilled player on the team who thought the world of the sweet little boy. For the most part, Justin seemed to be a happy child. No one ever noted him seeming depressed or despondent, though all have mentioned this aura around him which suggested something was a little off, but they can never put their finger on it. Some of this may have come out of the crumbling of his parents' marriage, and how the separation kept him from having the tight family unit he hoped for. Victor, or Buddy as he's often known, and Elaine had what most would describe as a toxic and difficult relationship. The couple began experiencing issues early on, having married in January of 76. As the years went on, that relationship continued to unravel, with the two hardly being able to coexist by the mid-80s. They would eventually divorce, with Buddy obtaining primary custody of Justin. According to friends and family, custody was awarded to the father due to Elaine having been accused of committing adultery during the course of the marriage. This was a hot point of contention between the two as, according to several family members, Buddy was seeing a woman named Pamela during the marriage, and not long after the divorce, he married her. Elaine, too, would remarry, this time to a man named Russell Pace, and the two would live together in the town of Somerville, approximately 12 miles southwest of Buddy's home in the town of Monk's Corner, South Carolina. Elaine cared deeply for her son, and despite the court ruling, maintained contact with him through weekend visits and daily phone calls. She was in the process of attempting to have the custody arrangement changed when her beloved child went mysteriously missing. It was the morning of Friday, March 3rd, 1989. Justin, 5 years old at the time, was getting ready for his last day of school before the weekend. Getting himself dressed, the child made breakfast, a small bowl of Cinnamon Toast Crunch cereal. According to his stepmother, Pamela, she hopped into the shower without looking at the clock and, moments later, heard a small knock at the door. The time was approximately 11 a.m., and Justin popped his head in, saying that he was going over to the neighbors to wait for the bus, something that he did every morning, though usually Pam accompanied him. For whatever reason, on this particular morning, Pamela said goodbye to Justin and continued on with her shower. Justin's home was located at the end of a long dirt driveway which connected to Horseshoe Road. The walk from his door to the bus stop was approximately 100 yards. Somewhere along that short distance, something went wrong, as Justin never made it to the bus stop. Neither his best friend Justin Smith nor the grandmother had seen him that day. At the time, they'd assumed he'd gotten sick or had an appointment. No one thought much of it, and as far as Pamela knew, Justin had gotten on the bus and gone to school. The first time there was any indication that Justin hadn't gone to school came nearly 4 hours later, when Pamela went to pick him up from the bus stop. At approximately 3 p.m., the bus came moving down Horseshoe Road, stopping at its usual spot. The doors split open and a few children came bouncing down the stairs to meet their waiting parents, but Justin wasn't there. It was at this time that Pamela asked the driver where the 5-year-old was and was informed that he'd never gotten on the bus that morning. Pamela, 29 at the time, quickly placed 2 phone calls once she'd learned about the absence. First, to the boy's father, 34-year-old Victor Lee Buddy Turner, who was working as a pipe welder for General Dynamics that morning, and second, to the Berkeley County Sheriff's Department to report him missing. According to dispatch records, the 911 call came in at precisely 3:12 p.m. How exactly law enforcement responded to this call and how seriously they took the child's disappearance becomes somewhat of a matter of perspective. While local law enforcement has been adamant that they took things extremely seriously at the time, Justin's mother Elaine and his stepfather Russell have always been of the belief that the response was not quick enough and the seriousness of the disappearance was not recognized until days later. Russell would later tell the Post and Courier that investigators had two responses to the call. First, to dismiss the five-year-old's disappearance as being a typical runaway situation, believing that he'd eventually return on his own. And second, they turned their attention towards Elaine. Being that there was a divorce situation and Elaine was working to have the custody agreement changed, authorities initially theorized that it was entirely possible the mother had come to Monk's Corner and abducted Justin that morning before he got on the bus. That was quickly ruled out, however, when it was determined that both Elaine and Russell had been at work when they'd received the calls about Justin's disappearance. Denise Finley, one of Justin's cousins, later told the Berkeley Observer that, in those early days, Elaine received multiple calls from police. Denise explained, quote, "They were calling to find out what she had done with Justin. Her response each time was, 'I don't have my son. Will you please find my son?'" End quote. According to the Sheriff's Department, the first two deputies to arrive on the scene following the 911 call were James Gaithers and Philip Mason. According to Gaithers, after taking the initial report, they began searching through the home and surrounding property, wondering if perhaps Justin had chosen not to go to school and was hiding or hanging out somewhere nearby. Deputy Gaithers later testified that deputies did search the camper twice that first day, though he was careful in his wording, noting that the searches had not been complete and were more along the lines of going inside and looking around, but not really moving or shifting any objects or furniture. Deputy Mason, however, testified that he did search that camper on Friday and opened the compartment where Justin was later found, though that day he swore there was no sign of the boy in there. Deputy Mason would later qualify this statement, saying that while he did open the compartment, he didn't get down low and look all the way inside of it. Deputy Mason later failed a polygraph when asked whether or not he had actually searched the trailer, though he would state he couldn't understand how he failed. The search of the camper is one of the most significant points of contention and confusion in the entire investigation and does not only involve police. Both Justin's paternal grandmother and a neighbor have stated they either witnessed or were directly involved in searching the camper before the child was found. Searches for Justin were conducted over the course of the next 48 hours. On Friday, deputies canvassed the neighborhood, speaking with neighbors about the morning of the boy's disappearance. None had actually seen the little boy exiting his home that day, nor had anyone seen him at or approaching the bus stop. Early theories examine the possibility that Justin might have been grabbed by someone before exiting his property, perhaps toward the end of his driveway, but there was one detail which everyone seemed to agree on. Whoever had taken the child had likely been someone he knew and felt comfortable with. Shy by nature, he wouldn't have willingly gone along with a stranger. Elaine and Russell were quite clear that they'd been through the dangers of strangers with the boy and that he simply wasn't the type to wander off on his own or go away with an unknown person. Despite the growing urgency and hoping to find Justin alive, the more time passed, the more concerned investigators became. While early searches had predominantly been made up of sheriff's deputies, by Sunday, March 5th, the search team grew to include police, members of the State Law Enforcement Division, or SLED, search and rescue squads, as well as friends and neighbors. Strangely, no members from Elaine's side of the family were allowed to help in those searches. In fact, they weren't even allowed on the Turner's property. This may have been as a result of the initial belief that Elaine had somehow been involved in Justin's disappearance. More than 100 people assembled at the Turner's home at approximately 7:45 a.m. that Sunday morning and began being assigned different areas to search. By the time the groups began moving out, it was just after 8 a.m. According to former Sheriff M.C. Cannon, at approximately 8:30 a.m., Victor Buddy Turner walked towards the camper and pulled open the door, stepping inside. Cannon later expressed his confusion about that move, saying that the camper had already been searched several times. Not long after going in, Buddy turned and, according to Cannon, called out, quote, "My lord, there he is, right there," end quote. Calls went out over walkie-talkies carried by searchers notifying them that the child had been found and, tragically, was dead. Ralph Hamer, captain of the Berkeley County Rescue Squad, described the scene to the Index Journal. Justin had been found beneath a bench seat in the dining area of the camper. Captain Hamer explained, quote, "Underneath that top lid was a little sliding door, and he was underneath there. But it wasn't tight enough for him to suffocate, and it wasn't cold enough for him to freeze. It's just a mystery how he got there." End quote. The discovery of Justin's body immediately changed everything, and now police had to lock down the scene so they could sweep for evidence. This was, of course, problematic, as over the course of the two previous days, hundreds of people had been through the home and all over the property. Beyond that, multiple people, including law enforcement, stated that they had searched the trailer previously. When asked about the location in which Justin had been found, Sheriff Cannon was at a loss for words, telling the Journal, quote, "I can't imagine how anybody could have carried that child in and out and around the neighborhood with everybody in there scared and alert about a missing child. But I can't doubt the word of the men who said they looked in there." End quote. The state of Justin's body caused some confusion as well. Police reported that the body was very cold to the touch, seemingly colder than it should have been, as temperatures in the area had not fallen below 58 degrees during the time that he had been missing. Beyond that, authorities noted that there was a lack of decomposition, and water droplets were noted as being on both his forehead and nose. While at the time, an autopsy was still pending, there began to be theories that maybe the child had been killed and then stored in a refrigerator before being placed in the small compartment inside the camper. Following this horrible discovery, investigators began moving forward with the next steps in the case, these primarily being to question the parents again. While deputies separated Pamela and Buddy, other deputies sat down to speak with Elaine and Russell. What exactly was said by anyone during these early interrogations has never been fully revealed, but it's quite apparent that none of them seemed to know what could have happened, nor how Justin could have ended up in that camper. According to investigators, Pamela told the story that she had told the same day she'd reported him missing, that he'd left for school while she was in the shower, and she had no idea anything was wrong until hours later when he didn't get off the bus. Justin's body was removed from the compartment and taken to Berkeley County Coroner William B. Smith Jr., who would conduct the autopsy. At this time, deputies from the Sheriff's Department were joined by 8 members of SLED, 4 crime scene technicians and 4 agents who were to assist in the collection of evidence. The camper was thoroughly searched, as well as photographed and dusted for prints. The Turner's home was also subject to a search, and investigators went through it from top to bottom. Several items were removed from the home, later revealed in court documents to have been a dog leash, sheets, tissues, Justin's underwear, cereal, as well as hair and fibers. Many of these items were taken to the state lab in Columbia for analysis. According to the details of a warrant released a time later, crime scene technicians also inspected a freezer located inside of a storage shed on the property. At the time, investigators collected hair, fibers, blood, and latent fingerprints. When asked about potential suspects, authorities stated they had not found any evidence which would directly implicate Elaine, nor had they found anything which could be tied to Pamela or Buddy. Much of the investigation at that point hinged on the results of the autopsy and what answers could be provided through evidence analysis at the crime lab. Sheriff Cannon, when asked about concerned parents in the area, replied, quote, "I can't say it's not a lunatic running around, and I can't tell them not to be afraid. I don't know who's running around out there, but apparently someone who would do anything is out there. Somebody put him in there. Definitely, he didn't put himself in there." End quote. On Monday, March 6th, Coroner Smith completed his report and released it to investigators. Perhaps the most pertinent question at the time, it was revealed that Justin's death had been the result of a homicide, with the manner of death being stated as strangulation. According to the autopsy, the 5-year-old had been strangled with a thin object, at the time speculated to have been a small belt or perhaps a dog leash. Even more disturbingly, the report confirmed that Justin had been sexually assaulted as well. His body, at the time it was discovered, had been described in local newspapers as being, quote, fully dressed. However, Sheriff Cannon stated after release of the autopsy report that Justin's pants had been pulled down, described as being a third of the way down his legs. The forensic examination showed that the killer had inserted a cylindrical object into the child, though they could not confirm if this assault had taken place before or after his death. No semen was present, though, and further examinations could find no injuries or signs that the child had been sexually assaulted previously, suggesting that this had been done around the time of his death and was not part of a longer history of abuse. While investigators have never named what type of object was used to assault the child, if indeed they know for sure, the two which have most commonly been mentioned in leaks from those who allege to be close to the case were either a broom handle or possibly a soda bottle. The coroner at that time was not able to pinpoint a time of death for Justin, which added a lot of confusion to the case. Investigators needed to determine whether the child had been killed the day he'd gone missing, or if perhaps he'd been killed sometime after the searches had already begun. Knowing this information might help determine whether or not Justin had been in that camper the entire time, or if he had been placed inside the storage compartment after the searches were already underway. Sheriff Cannon expressed his frustration about the timing to the media, telling the Index Journal, quote, "We simply don't have enough autopsy results to do something with. It was a sad and bad situation to start with, and then we've run aground with what we've got. This is a big issue. It's changed and twisted and bent, so we simply don't know. They've talked about 30 hours, then 7 hours, then 6 hours. That's what's wrong now." End quote. One thing seemed to be quite clear, however. It was highly unlikely a stranger had abducted the child and then hidden him inside the trailer after assaulting and strangling him. On Tuesday, March 7th, more than 200 people gathered at the Parks funeral home to pay their respects to the child and his family. Justin was laid out in a brown coffin, dressed in clothing he had picked out in advance for family photos, which were to be taken with his mother and stepfather. He wore a white shirt, navy sweater, gray pants, brown leather shoes, and a red print bow tie. Lying in his coffin, Justin was surrounded by his favorite things: a baseball t-shirt from the Ladson All-Stars, a ball signed by his favorite player, L.M. Garrick, a pound puppy, and a California Raisins doll. He was laid to rest in a mausoleum in Somerville Cemetery. This same day, deputies and SLED agents met with pathologists at Medical University Hospital to go over the autopsy. Several new details about the autopsy came out through interviews with investigators over the course of the next few days. Firstly, it was stated that at the time Justin's body was found, he was grasping a small clump of hair between his fingers. At the time, they didn't know where the hair had come from, and it was sent out to the lab for analysis, with hopes that it might help identify the killer. Tests would later conclude it was animal hair, though it's never been specified what type of animal. Testing of food found in Justin's stomach helped narrow down his time of death, as pathologists at University Hospital stated the child had likely been killed between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. on Friday the 3rd, the day he was reported missing. Considering this new time frame and the location where Justin was found, the attention of authorities began focusing in more closely on Buddy and Pamela, with the latter being the last to have seen Justin alive. On Wednesday, March 8th, agents from SLED arrived at the Turner's home, with each being taken down to their Columbia headquarters for questioning in separate cars. SLED agents were joined by Berkeley County Sheriff's Lieutenant Randy Herod for the interrogations, which lasted approximately 4 hours. Both Pamela and Buddy were also polygraphed on this day, with Sheriff Cannon telling the Index Journal that there was no hint of suspicion at the time and the polygraphs were routine. However, the Charlotte Observer reported that, when asked if they were suspects, Sheriff Cannon had replied, "We think so." Between Wednesday the 8th and Friday the 10th, local newspapers produced a slew of articles about the case, many of which included quotes from apparent insiders revealing details which were not publicly confirmed. According to investigators, the release of this information was seriously impeding their ability to conduct a thorough investigation. And so the Berkeley County Sheriff's Department issued a statement imposing a freeze on releasing information again. Lieutenant Sidney Wren, the lead investigator on the case, told the Index Journal, quote, "There's no way we can allow the news media to interfere with the investigation. There's no way we're going to let anything else go until we get further along with it," end quote. Lieutenant Wren pointed towards the day the Turners were brought in for questioning, adding, quote, "We were trying to get these people to cooperate with us, and here were all these cameras being stuck into their faces. We're not going to make any more statements of any kind until we finish what we're attempting to accomplish," end quote. Following the media blackout, frustrations began growing on all sides of the case. Community leaders and town council members began speaking out about a lack of progress. W. Gene Woods Jr. of the town council told the Sumter Item that members of the community had been writing letters and making calls to complain about the situation, noting that as weeks and months began passing, there didn't appear to be any new developments. Shirley Burnett, Elaine's mother and Justin's grandmother, also spoke to the Item, venting her frustration that by May, a killer was still walking the streets. Shirley begged for a resolution, saying, quote, "There just has to be an arrest. Somewhere, there has to be some answers," end quote. Dale T. Cobb, a lawyer hired by the Turners, shared his hope that police would find the killer and stated that his clients had no knowledge of where the case was at, saying that investigators had been keeping them in the dark. This may have been due to issues investigators were having with Buddy and Pamela, though. According to authorities, following their questioning and the polygraphs, the couple had hired lawyers and were no longer cooperating. After their first polygraph tests had returned inconclusive results, the couple had apparently agreed to take new tests, but changed their mind, saying they would not take polygraphs again under the advice of their lawyers. Sadly, while the case itself was being worked away from the bright lights of media inquiry, it appears that a feud between different departments may have been hindering the work of those who sought to find answers. Now, all of this depends on what side of the argument you choose to believe, but as it played out in the media, the feud was solidly between Coroner William B. Smith Jr. and the Sheriff's Department. According to the Sumter Item, Lieutenant Wren was hoping that the coroner would hold an inquest, which might provide answers to some of the questions they'd been asking. Smith, however, was adamant that he would not conduct a coroner's inquest until he felt the time was right, saying, quote, "The case won't die because as the coroner, I'm speaking for Justin Turner and thinking of him. It will not be swept under the rug and forgotten about. We will not jump haphazardly into a coroner's inquest until we have completed a thorough review of the Sheriff's Department's investigation," end quote. In June, 3 months after Justin's death, the Charlotte Observer reported that the feud seemed to develop as Coroner Smith had ambitions of becoming sheriff. Several unnamed sources told reporters that, as a result of Smith wanting to be sheriff, it was believed he was purposefully taking actions to hinder the investigation with hopes of making the sheriff's department look bad. Lieutenant Wren referred to it as a pathetic situation that was extremely disappointing. Wren noted that they had been seeking an inquest but were being blocked by Smith, explaining that with an inquest, quote, "We could put it all together and bring it all out before the public. Everything we've done and everything that's going on. Subpoena all the potential witnesses and let them tell the world everything they know," end quote. Of course, later in life, Wren seems to have a different recollection of events. In 2014, he told the Post and Courier that, at the time, he had a meeting with Coroner Smith where he specifically requested that the coroner not intervene or hold an inquest, and that Smith had agreed. But days later, newspaper headlines began reporting that Smith was finalizing plans to hold an inquest in August. With reports of a dispute between investigators and the coroner's office, the Ninth Circuit Solicitor's Office began examining the situation to determine whether or not they needed to get involved. Unfortunately, it seems, Justin's death and the investigation into it was slowly being politicized, and while many involved sought to find answers, others hoped to better their positions through it. As Russell Pace later told the Post and Courier, quote, "There was a lot of grandstanding going on between some of the investigators and the press. A lot of things were said that weren't necessarily true and had to be retracted later. It was a sloppy investigation at the time." End quote. The coroner's inquest was officially scheduled to begin on Monday, August 21st, but it would end prematurely due to a medical emergency. We'll get into that after a quick word from this week's sponsors. Has this ever happened to you? You need to see a doctor. You search and you find one that looks good. You wait on hold to book an appointment. You rearrange your schedule. And when you finally go in, you find out this doctor doesn't even take your insurance. That's very annoying, but there's a solution. ZocDoc. Just download the free ZocDoc app, the easiest way to find a great doctor and instantly book an appointment. With ZocDoc, you can search for local doctors who take your insurance, read verified patient reviews, and book an appointment in person or video chat. Never wait on hold with a receptionist again. Go to ZocDoc.com/trace and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free. ZocDoc makes healthcare easy. Now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/trace and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. Many are available as soon as today. That's ZocDoc.com/trace. Making content is an essential part of what I do to keep this show going, but it hasn't always been a seamless creative process. Inserting sound effects, creating videos, posting on social media, updating the website can be really difficult for someone challenged by the limitations of my own personal design skill level. Ever since I found Canva Pro, though, I can design anything like a pro on any device. Canva Pro is a design platform that empowers you to create and share stunning content in just a few clicks. Whether you're a design professional or just getting started, designing with Canva Pro is amazing, fast, and fun. Choose from thousands of professionally made templates that are easy to customize with simple drag and drop features, or start from scratch. Canva Pro comes with endless premium fonts, photos, videos, and so much more that add personality and edge to whatever you're designing. I was blown away by how many different options there are, with design possibilities being virtually endless. One of my favorite aspects of Canva Pro is how I can have all of this in one subscription, which means never having to pay for another image or design again. My favorite Canva Pro feature is Magic Resize, where you can quickly and efficiently resize any design for whatever format you need, whether it's for social media posts, YouTube videos, or your own website. I really love how quick and easy it is, and how it never reduces the quality of my creation, making it look sharp and professional when I post it. I've recently been using this for YouTube thumbnails, and it's made a really difficult task fast and easy, and I kind of want to do it more. Design like a pro with Canva Pro. Right now, you can get a free 45-day extended trial when you use my promo code. Just go to canva.me/trace to get your free 45-day extended trial. That's canva.me/trace. canva.me/trace. I should probably explain. A coroner's inquest is very different from a trial or grand jury proceeding. An inquest is open. Nothing is hidden from the public as it would be in a grand jury, so testimony, witnesses, and evidence are all available for public view. Beyond that, an inquest is held to determine how someone died and, if criminal in nature, who should be charged with that crime. However, they are not grounded by rules and laws that apply to trials. Therefore, what could be ruled out during trial as hearsay is fully admissible in the coroner's inquest. A 6-person jury sits on the inquest to determine whether or not charges should be filed, and the coroner wears 2 hats, basically, being both investigator and judge. The first day of the inquest, held on Monday, August 21st, had its share of issues. Primarily, when both Pamela and Buddy were called to testify, neither would answer any questions, instead invoking their Fifth Amendment right, which protects them from self-incrimination. This was done under the advice of their lawyers. The Greenville News published part of the transcript in which Coroner Smith asks, "Did you kill Justin Lee Turner?" And Pamela responds, quote, "My attorney has advised me not to answer any questions," end quote. Both Pamela and Buddy stated that they would stand by statements they had previously made to SLED, but would not answer questions at the inquest, with their lawyers explaining that, due to the open nature of the proceedings with no privacy or protections, they didn't think it was in the best interest of their clients to answer any questions at all. Another witness who was called during this first day was Dr. Clay Nichols, a medical examiner at Medical University. Dr. Nichols testified that it was believed Justin had been sexually assaulted very close to the time of his death, though they couldn't prove if it had happened before or after. In regard to the early theories that Justin had been stored in a cold location and placed in the camper later, Dr. Nichols explained that they had found no evidence to support that theory, and it was his belief there was no significant time difference between when Justin had been killed and when he had been placed in the camper's storage area. In total, 16 witnesses testified on that first day. The second day of testimony never had a chance to get underway before a medical situation led to the entire inquiry being stopped. On the morning of Tuesday, August 22nd, Coroner Smith became ill and collapsed on a couch in the judge's chambers at the Berkeley County Courthouse. Smith was rushed to Trident Regional Medical Center, where he was immediately admitted to the cardiac care unit. County attorneys announced the end of the inquiry, noting that, should a second inquest be held, it wouldn't occur until later in the fall due to the court schedule. Prior to this abrupt ending, attorneys Dale Cobb and Lionel Lofton had announced their plans to have Smith removed from the inquest, suggesting that he had compromised the neutral nature of the inquest when he took the jury's foreman to the Turners' home to examine the crime scene without the other jury members or any lawyers being present. Lofton explained to the Index Journal, quote, "I don't think we can go forward with this jury because the process is tainted. I don't think there's any way you can clean up the record," end quote. While Smith was ultimately accused of jury tampering, the rules surrounding an inquest are very different from those as a trial, as I explained earlier. An investigation was conducted, and in November, Smith, who had recovered from his health issues, was cleared of any wrongdoing. So he scheduled a second inquiry. On Monday, December 18th, the second inquiry officially began, once again being overseen by Coroner Smith. The first witness to testify was Deputy James Gaithers, who stated that after being notified on Friday, March 3rd, he arrived at the Turners' home where he began searching. Deputy Gaithers noted that he searched the Turners' house twice that day and took a quick look through the camper, though he saw no signs of Justin. In addition to Deputy Gaithers, a total of 70 witnesses were issued subpoenas, including Russell Pace, Elaine Pace, Victor Buddy Turner, and Pamela Turner. Curiously, on the first day of this inquest, though, neither Pamela nor Buddy showed up. Coroner Smith stated that the couple had individually been sent letters and subpoenas earlier in the month, but they'd recently moved to Spartanburg and may not have received them. In their absence, testimony regarding the results of their polygraph tests was given, and it was certainly strange to say the least. According to investigators, the polygraph results were ruled inconclusive, not due to any issues with the technology, but instead the witnesses themselves. According to this testimony, Buddy and Pamela had apparently tried to skew the results of the test by taking sedatives before it was given. Lieutenant Wren later stated that they had taken Valium, and when that was discovered, they were asked to take polygraphs a second time without the Valium. But by that time, their lawyers became involved and advised them against taking the polygraph again at all. One of their lawyers, Dale Cobb, in an effort to appease investigators, arranged for Buddy and Pamela to take polygraphs given by an independent firm. Members of this firm testified that both had passed their tests, though exactly what questions they were asked was unknown. Only one question was revealed when witnesses from the firm stated that each had answered no when asked if they knew how Justin died, and the test had shown they were telling the truth. Sticking with polygraph results, this inquest also revealed that Deputy Mason, who stated he had searched the camper on the property on Friday, failed a polygraph test when asked about that search. Sheriff's Department Detective David Lee Clayton took the stand to testify about evidence taken from the Turner home. Detective Clayton stated that a dog leash located inside the house closely matched markings on Justin's neck discovered during the autopsy. Additional testing at the crime lab, however, failed to produce any traces of human blood or tissue on that leash. Neighbors, who were called to testify, noted that they had never seen or heard anything to suggest Justin had been mistreated or abused during his time living with Buddy and Pamela. A SLED criminal psychology expert, David A. Caldwell, testified that Justin had likely been killed by someone who knew him. Throughout the entirety of the first day of the inquest, Elaine Pace sat listening teary-eyed while clutching a teddy bear Justin used to sleep with. Following the first day's proceedings, agents from SLED were sent to Spartanburg to track down the Turners. The agents staked out their home, though they saw no sign of the couple that Monday night. At the time, it was decided to ensure there was round-the-clock monitoring of the home, but without making contact with the Turners, the second day of testimony began without their presence. It was during this second day that it became clear there was a lot of disagreement and animosity between family members on each side of the case. One of the more lurid details was revealed when relatives testified that Pamela had laughed while watching news reports about Justin's murder, referred to the police as stupid, and in their opinion, did not seem the slightest bit upset about the child's death. There was additional testimony which claimed that on the day Justin's body was found, a dispute broke out between family members which led to a shoving match between different relatives. Following the end of Tuesday's testimony, SLED agents managed to locate Pamela and Buddy in Spartanburg, at which time they were served with subpoenas and told they were required to attend the inquest the following day, Wednesday, December 20th. This third day dug further into relations between different sides of the family and involved accusations that Pamela and Buddy had not been entirely truthful when they spoke to investigators. Buddy's own mother, Peggy Still Ames, recorded a phone conversation she had with Pamela's mother, Eva Stalvey. While Ames felt the family should be more actively involved in the investigation and the search for Justin's killer, Stalvey felt they should stay out of it and leave it up to the police. Ames went on to testify that on March 8th, when Pamela and Buddy were questioned by SLED, her son told her that they had been accused of the crime. Ames stated that Buddy, quote, was shaking so bad he couldn't get a cigarette out of his pack, end quote. According to Ames, her son told her that investigators accused Pamela of committing the crime and accused him of helping her cover it up. Ames also testified that she and several other witnesses had been in the stables after Justin's body was found, and there, in the soil between two hay bales, was the impression of what appeared to be a child's body. This statement was backed up by Sandra Jacobs, Pamela's sister, who described the impression as, quote, so perfect it almost looked like a drawing, end quote. Both women stated they had informed investigators about this figure in the soil, but according to their knowledge, no detective had gone to the stable to look into it. Beyond this, Jacobs testified that her sister was reportedly frightened as police searched the Turner home the day Justin's body was found. Jacobs stated that Pamela worried police would find a pair of handcuffs she owned, but according to Jacobs, investigators never did find those handcuffs. Pamela's parents, Eva and James Stalvey, were called to testify, referring to their daughter as a sweet, kind, and gentle woman who loved Justin deeply. From the stand, they accused family members of being involved in a conspiracy with investigators to frame Pamela for the murder. James stated that after the discovery of Justin's body, he had requested for investigators to bring in tracking dogs to hopefully lead them to who had placed Justin in the trailer, but police told him the dogs couldn't help in the investigation at that point. James also told a strange story about days leading up to the discovery of Justin's body. According to him, at approximately 1 a.m. on Saturday, March 4th, he saw an unknown man with a flashlight moving near a pile of dirt on the Turner's property. James stated the area was well lit and there was no need for a flashlight. Allegedly, when he approached, the man quickly began walking away. When he asked him who he was, the man supposedly replied that he was Elaine Turner's brother, but James never got a good look at his face. James said he doesn't know, nor has he ever met Elaine's brother, so he couldn't identify him by sight either way. He claimed to have told police about this incident, though what investigating, if any, was done has never surfaced. Eva Stalvey testified she was present when an investigator had thoroughly searched the camper on Saturday the 4th, saying that the man had opened everything, even the drawers and cabinets. That deputy was Detective David Lee Clayton, who testified he'd conducted a brief search of the camper because he had been told it was already searched. Clayton stated, quote, "I didn't look in the area where the body was found. I didn't even know those compartments existed until Sunday," end quote. At one point, as evidence was being presented, the shoes Justin was wearing when his body was found were shown to the jury, and Elaine broke down into tears. His shoes were untied when he had been killed. Final testimony was given on the third day. Upon completion, the jury came back and recommended that a warrant be issued for the arrest of Pamela Turner for homicide. There in the courtroom, Pamela was cuffed and arrested after Coroner Smith swore out a warrant based on the jury's recommendation. Pamela was remanded to the county jail. It was reported by the Index Journal that both Pamela and Buddy once again took the fifth to every question they were asked at this inquest, and that when the jury's verdict was read aloud, Pamela had no visible reaction to it. At that point, the case shifted over to the Ninth Circuit Solicitor's Office, but Deputy Solicitor Steve Davis was unsure how things would move forward. Davis told the media that he was under no legal obligation to proceed with the case, and his office would need to review the case, as well as the inquest transcripts, before deciding whether or not to take it before the grand jury. He noted the differences between the rules of a courtroom and the rules of an inquest, saying that what may have convinced the jury at the inquest might not even be admissible before a grand jury. The next day, Thursday the 21st, Circuit Judge Richard Field set Pamela's bail at $100,000 following a 40-minute hearing. Her lawyer, Dale Cobb, told the Gaffney Ledger that both Pamela's sister and parents had offered up their homes as collateral towards the bond. In total, the bond would be secured with $65,000 worth of property and $3,000 cash. When asked what he planned to do in defense of his client, Cobb replied, quote, "The next step in the process is the solicitor has to decide whether he's going to submit this case to the grand jury, if so, and when," end quote. That decision wouldn't come about until later in January of 1990, when the solicitor's office decided to take the evidence before a grand jury. On Friday, February 23rd, following 3 days of testimony, the grand jury returned an indictment against Pamela Turner for the strangulation murder of Justin. Both Victor and Pamela requested to testify before the grand jury, though with these proceedings not being of public record, what they said is unknown. Following the indictment, a trial was set to begin 6 months later in August, though Deputy Solicitor Davis agreed to delay the trial until October, when Pamela's attorney requested more time to prepare a defense for his client. The trial, however, would never take place. On Tuesday, November 13th, Deputy Solicitor Davis dropped all charges against Pamela Turner. When asked about this decision, Davis told the Sumter Item, quote, "We felt it would be in the best interest to dismiss this indictment. I hate to use words, total lack of evidence. It went more to the insufficiency of the evidence," end quote. Davis stated that the results of forensic investigations by the Medical University of South Carolina had led to the charges being dropped, as they could not definitively link Pamela to the murder. Justin's stepfather, Russell Pace, told reporters that a meeting being held between family members and the solicitor's office also played a role. Essentially, the belief was that the evidence wasn't solid enough to get a conviction, and no one wanted to see a situation of double jeopardy. At that time, Davis told reporters that despite dropping charges, they could be reinstated at any time, and Pamela Turner had not been ruled out as a suspect. 2 months after charges were dropped, in January of 1991, news broke that a new witness had come forward. This witness claimed not only to have been present on Horseshoe Road the day Justin had disappeared, but that he had actually witnessed this abduction. If true, this witness might be investigators' strongest chance of finally solving what was quickly becoming one of the most difficult and tragic cases in Berkeley County history. As it turned out, however, they had been aware of this witness since almost the first day. Next week in part two, we'll dig into a lot of developments, contradictions, and confusing details. Why had investigators ignored this apparent eyewitness to the abduction? Could a new sheriff finally put the investigation back on track? Or would a conflict between his office and the prosecutors once again lead to infighting, delaying justice? We'll also get into the analysis of new evidence and how it impacted the investigation, a lawsuit filed against investigators by Justin's mother, how media coverage changed and impacted this case, a potential suspect changing their name, and how, 30 years later, DNA may hold the answers to finally solving this horrible case. Trace evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Aurora K, Bacon Bits the Cat, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Dave Allen, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Heather Louise, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Marla Wright, Melissa Brekeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levonen, Sarah Mascaratolo, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, Tracy Woods, and Walter Jansen. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. If you haven't already, please consider rating the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. 5 stars would be greatly appreciated, but it's up to you. Share these episodes, spread the word, and maybe together we can help bring justice to those who have been deprived of it. Thank you all once again for listening, supporting the show, and for being the best listeners a podcaster could ask for. Thank you again for listening to this episode, and I hope you'll join me next week for The Murder of Justin Turner, Part 2.